This is the Mideast Madness Show on Free Radio Santa Cruz. Live show for Monday, September 30, 2013, at 3:01 p.m. Pacific Daylight Time. I give you the time and date so you know that we're live, and at your behest, you may call in at any time directly to the studio and go on the air with me for whatever reason you desire. Area code 831-427-3772. 427-3772. In the Santa Cruz County, California area code of 831. This is Ren. Thanks for joining me. Now, I got two browsers up here. I spent the last 45 minutes trying to download a program. The internet aired, episode of Mideast Madness from 2 days ago. And 5 minutes before the top of the hour, it tells me it failed. Download failed. I don't know why it does that. I suppose it's all my fault. At any rate, ooh. Now, on the weekend edition of Mideast Madness, which airs, as it were, airs for you every Saturday starting at 11 a.m., I talked a bit about, I read several dispatches from the United Nations News Center. I may as well start with a couple more of those. You see, sometime after Labor Day, the United Nations inaugurates its annual beginning of business. Very similar to how multinational corporations and other big business entities begin their fiscal year after Labor Day, and school starts. It's the real sort of secular, generic New Year's, having nothing to do with meteorological seasons. But so the UN convenes for, I believe, its 68th session. Here is a dispatch from today, September 30. Eritrean Foreign Minister urges General Assembly to reform the United Nations. See, the big part of the formalities of kicking up the UN activities again for a new year involves representatives from every nation, or at least every nation that cares to make a presentation, getting up there at the mic and saying what's foremost on their mind. So Eritrea is a relatively new nation. It's just a few years old. It used to be part of Ethiopia. They had some awful fighting there, wars, a civil war which resulted in the breakaway Republic of Eritrea. And Eritrea's foreign minister made a presentation today in New York at the UN, urging the General Assembly, where all the member nations of the world congregate, and ask them to reform the United Nations. The United Nations is debilitated, says their foreign minister, by chronic weaknesses and shortcomings and must be reformed. The foreign minister of Eritrea today said, urging also that sanctions against its country, its country of Eritrea, be lifted. The 21st century requires a revitalized United Nations that transcends a bipolar or unipolar world order and that is firmly rooted in the supremacy of and respect for international law and order. Minister of Foreign Affairs Osman Saleh Mohammed told the 68th General Assembly high-level debate. In his statement, Mr. Osman said that the current conditions on the Eritrean people are a result of, and I quote here, the perils of the world order that is driven by the rivalry of domineering superpowers, which uses Eritrea as one of the, quote, pawns, like in, when you play chess, you have pawns in the wider Horn of Africa / Middle East chessboard, end quote. Among the transgressions meted on the Eritrean people are the unlawful sanctions imposed by the Security Council in 2009 as part of its monitoring group on Eritrea and Somalia. The mandate of the expert panel monitoring compliance with sanctions against Somalia and Eritrea was extended this summer until 25 November 2014, next year. The transgressions that have been perpetrated against the people of Eritrea and other peoples in the past 20 years speak to the persistence of an unfair and unjust global order and the absence of a strong and representative United Nations, the foreign minister stressed. He urged the organization, the UN, to pass practical resolutions that are commensurate with its legal, political, and moral responsibilities to uphold the rule of law, bring an end to the invasion on Eritrea, lift the sanctions, terminate interventions that jeopardize the peace and stability of the Horn of Africa, and deter all actions that, and I quote, breed crises, loss of life, and destruction. Mr. Osman was speaking in his national capacity at the annual UN General Assembly Summit, where heads of state and government and other senior officials raise issues of importance to the countries they represent, which is sort of how I introduced this piece. The GA, or General Assembly, debate concludes tomorrow. So, judging by the emails I've been receiving since I'm on their email list, the UN's email list, these inaugural proceedings that happen usually in September around this time of year every year take about a week, and I've gotten some 50, 60, 70 dispatches. I've read a few of them on Saturday to you, and the debate concludes tomorrow, which doesn't appear to be so much a debate as it is a sounding board for individual members. Overall, I support the mission of the United Nations and the concept of a UN, despite all of the terrible things so many people seem to find wrong with the UN. You've got a very well-to-do nation on the whole here in the United States, which tends to resent these other smaller, weaker, and perhaps less significant countries, which very often are dictatorships or false democracies. The American people have seemed to have a hard time with them, you know, pushing us around, pushing the U.S. around, using the U.N. Pedestal, as it were, and lecturing us. The Americans tend to take it very personally when they do this at the UN, which for many nations is the only opportunity to get coverage for any of their opinions, or at least the governments of these other countries, smaller countries' opinions about the way things should be run. So you've got Americans with their nationalistic resentment against being pushed around, if only by their words. And you've got these various small and quote-unquote less significant nations around the world who resent the U.S. for not listening to them and not taking them seriously. I say again, though, I support the mission of the United Nations. And I wish I could remember the details of why there are current sanctions on the people of Eritrea. But, you know, it's really a darn shame since Eritrea became a nation, I don't know, about 10, 15 years ago. The people of Tigray were denied their nationhood, even though they were allied with the Eritrean rebels, and supposedly Tigray was supposed to end up on the world map too, but that did not happen, so you got a bunch of resentment there. But a nation which has just come about, like Eritrea and perhaps South Sudan or Southern Sudan, which is younger still as a 21st century nation, they become granted the status of recognized nationality, and then they have sanctions put on them right away. Well, it's a rough road, folks. Okay, let's see what the next UN dispatch is. Just a little bit of news to pass along to you. UN chemical weapons investigators depart Syria after their six-day mission. September 30, the United Nations team investigating allegations of chemical weapons use in Syria has left the country after completing its six-day mission, a spokesperson for the world body said. I'd better put my headphones on. I was having this trouble last Saturday. I'm not a big fan of headphones, at least not in this studio. But as long as, you know, as long as I can figure out which pot to turn, we're in good shape. There should be no annoying feedback now. Okay, back to the UN dispatch. Back to the UN dispatch. The United Nations team investigating allegations of chemical weapons use in Syria has left the country of Syria after completing its six-day mission, a spokesperson for the world body said today. The team will now move on. Will now move to the phase of finalizing its report, which the team hopes will be ready by late October. UN spokesperson Martin Nazirki told reporters in New York. Led by Swedish scientist Åke Sällström, the team is mandated with evaluating all available information related to all allegations reported by member states for the purpose of preparing its final report. Those allegations include the 19 March incident at Khan al-Asal, reported first by Syria and subsequently by other member states. As previously agreed with Syria, the other allegations to be investigated include the 13 April incident at Sheikh Maqsood, reported by the United States, and the 29 April incident at Sarakweb, reported by France and the United Kingdom. In addition, the team has continued to follow up with the Syrian government and to evaluate information it has provided on three additional allegations. These are all allegations, apparently, that have to do with the illegal use of illegal chemical weapons. three additional allegations, including the incidents at Bakhariya on 22 August, at Jobar on 24 August, and at Sanaya on 25 August. After a visit to Syria, who knew that there were that many incidents involving CWs? We all kind of get the impression through mainstream media that it's one big notorious attack. After a visit to Syria last month, the team, assisted by experts from the World Health Organization, the WHO, and the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, OPCW, found, quote, clear and convincing evidence that sarin gas was used in an incident that occurred on 21 August in the Ghouta area on the outskirts of Damascus, in which hundreds of people were reportedly killed. In the wake of those findings, the Security Council last Friday called for the elimination of Syria's chemical weapons while endorsing a diplomatic plan for Syrian-led negotiations towards peace. Acting unanimously, the 15-member Security Council adopted a resolution calling for the speedy implementation of procedures drawn up by the OPCW, quote, for the expeditious destruction of the Syrian Arab Republic's chemical weapons program and stringent verification thereof, end quote. It underscored, quote, that no party in Syria should use, develop, produce, acquire, stockpile, retain, or transfer chemical weapons. Adding that defiance of the resolution would lead to measures under the UN Charter's binding Chapter 7, which can include sanctions or stronger coercive action. More than 100,000 people have been killed since the conflict in Syria began in March 2011, which began in the famous wake of the so-called Arab Spring, Over 2 million people have fled for safety to neighboring countries, and 4 million have been displaced within the country. For more details, you, my listeners, may go to the UN News Center at www.un.org/news. Easy enough to remember. You know, in spite of the bitterness and the cynicism that I may have used in describing the internal fighting within and without the UN. How could you have internal fighting without the UN? In spite of what I was saying, and even facing the fact that the UN has such a long way to go, as does the United States in appropriately dealing with global problems, I'm still encouraged by the events of, in particular, this past month, September. Today is the last day of September. If only because we have not seen so much activity towards the better. Not a whole lot is getting done, but warfare attack by the United States upon Syria, upon Damascus, which would have included the loss of many more civilian lives, has been averted for the time being. And there's just a lot of constructive activity, verbal as it may be, at the UN, and there's momentum going in an atmosphere which is infamous for nothing real happening, no little or no positive action going on, at least in dealing with the most serious of the world's problems, the most horrendous, involving, in this case, chemical weapons and a despotic regime in Damascus. But I can't help but be hopeful that the momentum which is going on now will make the other members of the UN hopeful. I think I'm starting to sound like a UN dispatch now. Interestingly enough, too, just as a kind of side note, Israel is feeling the heat because it's quite clear that Israel was counting on and even to some degree helping to direct Barack Obama's pronouncement of impending use of force on Damascus to punish them for using chemical weapons. In spite of all the high talk and the morality involved with applying pressure on the world stage about a major issue like chemical weapons, we haven't began firing the missiles, Tomahawks, crews, whichever they choose to use this time, from naval ships offshore in the Mediterranean, and that upsets Bibi Netanyahu, who apparently was counting on the implementation of these measures against Syria for a number of reasons, perhaps most importantly to continue to take attention off of the horrible policies that the Israeli government perpetrates on its so-called Arab citizens in Israel and the Palestinians who are under occupation in the territories, including the Gaza Strip, which is effectively still very much under occupation. And when Netanyahu met with the U.S. president today and yesterday, he threw his little temper tantrum saying he was also upset that Obama was talking with the new president of Iran, and that throws a big monkey wrench in Netanyahu and his political parties. Purposes to befuddle relations between the U.S., between Washington and Tehran, the capital of Iran. Little temper tantrum in the form of, no, you can't trust him. He's an Iranian. You can't trust him. He may be a new president, but he's they supposedly still say that they wanted to wipe Israel off the map, which, interestingly enough, is a phrase that never was used, at least not back when they were accused of using that phrase. When Ahmadinejad, the former president, was accused of, quote-unquote, wanting to wipe Israel off the map. I have a piece that I'd have to really dig for, so I'm not going to do that today, dating back a year or two ago, talking about how there is a runaway quality to a story like that, that the press just takes the ball and runs with, as it were, and repeats what is essentially a lie. Iran... there was no official statement or official policy statement coming out of Iran, the Iranian government under Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, that literally, quote-unquote, called for wiping Israel off the map. It's a fascinating example of how sometimes the press just irresponsibly goes the wrong way with unsubstantiated quotations and claims. Okay. This is the Mideast Madness Show on Free Radio Santa Cruz. I am Ren Tawil. It's 3:25 in the p.m. on this September 30th, 2013. I am trying to record the show. It is... okay, The oscillation image is just flailing away there. Now, let me go with one more UN News Center dispatch here. Greatest threat to the Muslim world comes from within, says a Malaysian leader warns a Malaysian leader in that leader's UN address. And that's from 2 days ago. Greatest threat to Muslim world comes from within. Malaysian leader warns in UN address. New York. The Malaysian Prime Minister used his address to the United Nations today to call on all peace-loving Muslims around the world to unite against the extremists who are using their religion as an excuse to commit violence, stressing that moderation is the key to winning the battle being waged for the future of Islam. Around the world, extremism is taking lives and crushing opportunity. This affects us all. But it is one people of one faith who suffer most, said Maud Najib bin Tun Haji Abdul Razak. I'll say it again so you have it under your belt there. Mr. Maud Najib bin Tun Haji Abdul Razak, the Prime Minister of Malaysia, Southeast Asian country there. A Muslim country, but not predominantly Muslim. He continued to say, I believe the greatest threat to Muslims today comes not from the world, not from the outside world, but from within. In his address to the General Assembly's annual high-level debate, the Prime Minister said the conflict between Sunni and Shia threatens the lives and livelihoods of millions of Muslims, from Syria and Lebanon to Iraq and Pakistan. That's actually a small stretch in the Arab world. Okay, a moderate stretch, geographically speaking. Our religion, founded on peace and premised on tolerance, is being twisted by extremists who are deploying false arguments to foster division and justify violence. Across the Islamic world, extremists are wrapping their perverse agenda in religious cloth, tearing families, countries, and the ummah apart. He stated, referring to the collective community of Muslims, the Ummah, U-M-M-A-H, collective community of Muslims. But Muslims are not powerless to act, Mr. Razak stated. I believe moderation in religion and the political process can stem the loss of life and liberty in the Muslim world. Behind the tragic violence, there is a battle being waged for the future of Islam, end quote. Mr. Razak said that by reaffirming the commitment to moderation and solving the political problems that drive instability, quote, we can seize back the center ground, end quote, and marginalize the extremists as well as advance an agenda for peace, harmony, and justice. I believe that peace-loving Muslims, the overwhelming majority of Muslims, should unite against the extremists who use our religion as an excuse to commit violence, he stated, adding that one of the most powerful tools in this regard is the practice of moderation. We should not mistake moderation for weakness, the Prime Minister went on to say. To face those baying for violence and call instead for calm is a sign not of frailty but of strength. Muslim leaders should speak up and condemn such violence, lest their silence is mistaken for acceptance. Very eloquent. It's not a brand new idea, and Prime Minister Razak is by no means the first major personality to stress the importance of moderation and truth in stemming the tide of violent extremism in Islam. Now, my voice is tiring already. I'll have a hot drink here. Stand by. The hot drink of which I spoke, by the way, is Indian chai with a little lemon, twist of lemon, that I bought at a 7-Eleven convenience store from an automatic dispensing hot drink machine. I'm so cultured and so ethnic. I will say, you know, I can understand people kind of poo-pooing this guy and saying, hey, we've heard it before, but even if I haven't heard it before, I'm not impressed with someone calling for moderation within the Islamic community. But at least it's happening, comes out of the lips of a head of state of what I believe is the second or third most populous Muslim majority nation on earth, and it's being said at the UN. So that's a fairly powerful launching point for expressing that. Also, this the initial thing that he's talking about here, the threat to the Muslim world comes not from without, from within. As soon as I read those words, it immediately brings to my own mind how the very same idea has been said about Israel for all the $3 billion plus dollars per year in military aid that Israel receives from Washington, D.C., and all of the highly unbalanced support that the Israeli nation, the Jewish state of Israel, is propped up with, especially from the United States. Here, the emphasis is being put on boosting their military so they can protect themselves in the traditional manner from threats from the outside and maybe from these terrible quote-unquote extremist quote-unquote terrorists among the Palestinian population, their so-called Arab-Israeli population and those who were under occupation. Merkava tanks, Divad jets, and well, not Divad, that whole project fell through a long time ago, I believe, but all these very high-technology weaponry that the IDF uses really to suppress the native population and keep them at bay while they expand their settlements in the territories. You know, the old Zionist dream. That kind of weaponry was meant for military threat from the outside. And if since Arab nations are almost without exception not attacking Israel these days and haven't for some decades now, at least with not by any major confrontation, they'll use this massive military power to suppress their own non-Jewish population, both inside and outside Israel, and this idea, this old-fashioned idea of defense through strength and maintaining the peace through military strength is not going to protect the Israelis from themselves, including their much-lauded free speech, which so many hardline Israelis tend to piss on anyway. They never like to hear from Haaretz or these other rather courageous news and opinion outlets about how Israel is going to do itself in merely by abandoning its own Judaic principles that its religion and its people were founded on as a people. You know, that's what it brings to my mind. The same thing, but you're talking about Islamic nations imploding from within instead of being invaded from without. The same applies to Israel, as far as I'm concerned. I'm mentioning this because it's automatically springs into my mind how Israel can do itself in by abandoning its most basic civilized principles. Abraham Lincoln, in one of his two inaugural addresses, 1861 or 65, I think it was the second one, made a famous statement, included a famous statement in the address, talking about how no European nation, no army from across the ocean could take a drink from the Ohio River or hold a hilltop in the Blue Ridge Mountains. Lincoln was simply pointing out that the United States was impermeable to attack. Perhaps he was had his fingers crossed behind his back while he was saying this, since we were undergoing a terrible civil war at the time of our own. But the point he was making, testing. Okay, I just wanted to make sure I was hearing myself. I thought I kicked the plug out for a moment. Just as Lincoln put it, perhaps we should not worry so much about invasions from without as we should worry about dissent and corruption and fighting from within. And sure enough, the country was torn apart by several measures, by a civil war. Some 150-odd years ago. And, yes, this was this year was the 150th anniversary of Gettysburg, the tide-turning battle in southern Pennsylvania. 2 months ago, July 2nd, 3rd, and 4th. Even the good old USA has to look at this at the two-pronged threat and ways of dealing not just courageously but creatively with the threat of our demise, whether it's by our own hand or by the hand of foreigners, if you will. Okay, Mideast Madness Show. I'm Ren. This is Free Radio Santa Cruz. It is 3:39 this September 30th. If you care, give me a call at area code 831-427-3772. 427-3772. You may also leave me a message at this program's email address, MideastMadness@gmx.com. MideastMadness@gmx.com. If you care to make it just a one-way communication, or when the show is over, you realize you wanted to tell me something that you forgot about while you were listening to me. And, okay, let's put aside the United Nations stuff for the time being. We spent a good two-thirds of an hour on those. Couple of quite interesting pieces about oil in Syria's Golan Heights, which is occupied by Israel, has been since 1967, and another one about possible comeback of a preference for armed insurrection by the Palestinians. But first, a commercial announcement. Where should the birds fly? Santa Cruz is a community on the Central California coast, some 70 miles south of San Francisco. The new Santa Cruz chapter of Jewish Voice for Peace, initiated just this past summer, JVP in conjunction with Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, the Resource Center for Nonviolence, and its Palestine-Israel Action Committee, is sponsoring a showing of the film Where Should the Birds Fly? By Fida Kista, a journalist and Palestinian resident of Gaza, on Wednesday, October 2nd. That's in 2 days, folks. Wednesday, October 2, at the Resource Center for Nonviolence. Fida will lead a discussion of the film and answer questions after the screening. The film is the story of two young women, Mona Samuni, now 13 years old, and Fida Kista, the filmmaker, now 29 years of age. Again, both are residents of Gaza who lived through Israel's Operation Cast Lead in December of 2008, January 2009. They live in the reality of Israel's siege and blockade of this tiny enclave. Few films document so powerfully and personally the impact of modern warfare and sanctions on a civilian population. The film tells the story of the efforts of Gazans to live and work under conditions of siege. It also documents the horrific Israeli military attack, the one that I mentioned, Operation Cast Lead, and the one last November, killing several hundred more people, including many children, and the struggles of these two women to maintain humanity, humor, and hope in a world that is anything but normal. Here's your chance to catch a flick or two in preview. A trailer of the film, or preview of the film, is available at whereshouldthebirdsfly.org. whereshouldthebirdsfly.org. Hope to see everyone at the film showing on Wednesday, October 2, at the Resource Center for Nonviolence, 612 Ocean Street. That is the still fairly new home of the RCNB, 612 Ocean Street in Santa Cruz, 7 o'clock p.m., admission is on a sliding scale of $5 to $10. However, as is normally the case at the Resource Center, no one will be turned away for lack of funds. The money is always good to take in, but the real importance here, really the whole idea, is the opportunity for educating the public. Therefore, no one will be turned away for lack of funds, but we do ask for a donation of $5 to $10. I say we because I'm a member in good standing of I'm an e-member anyway of the Resource Center for Nonviolence. I'm also active with the PIAC, Palestine Israel Action Committee. Again, the essential details: Where Should the Birds Fly? A film by Fida Kista. A powerfully moving, provocative film, the stories of two young, resilient Palestinian women struggling for normalcy in the cruel abnormality of Gaza. Meet the filmmaker, Fida Kista. She'll be there, as I said, taking questions and speaking with the peoples after the showing of the film. Sponsored by Jewish Voice for Peace Santa Cruz, Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, WILF, the Resource Center for Nonviolence, and the Palestine-Israel Action Committee. Tuesday, October... I caught it. No, Wednesday, October 2nd. Someone changed that to Tuesday down here. 2 days from now at 7 in the evening. Wednesday, October 2, 7 p.m. More info at info@jvp.org. info@jvp.org. The National Office, by the way, of Jewish Voice for Peace is... in Oakland, California. Oakland, California. Not far from Berkeley. Tell you what. We have an opportunity. Let me do the link for watching the trailer, and we'll see if we can glean anything of use from that. Vimeo. Deep Dish TV presents Where Should the Birds Fly?
I was born and raised here. Rafah is a town of fishermen and farmers, and thousands of Palestinians still living in camps, refugees forced from their homes by the creation of Israel. I remember the night the Israeli bulldozers came without warning. We hoped the white flag of peace would make them stop, but in the next 6 hours, they demolished 60 homes in our neighborhood.
That's 60.
A few years after we lost our home,
60 homes.
I learned how to use a camera and became a videographer, working with human rights observers. We often accompanied farmers who were trying to work their fields. Even the presence of international observers does not prevent daily random Israeli gunfire. The Israelis seem to be playing a deadly game with Palestinians who are just trying to work and live. Despite the danger and the gunfire, fishermen continue to take to the sea. Do they consciously intend to deprive them of the ability to make a living and feed their families? Israel's war in Gaza began without warning on December 27, 2008, with a massive F-16 and drone assault. They called it Operation Cast Lead. We call it a massacre. I had to capture the moment. I could see fear in everyone's eyes. The screaming children were the most horrible sight. But I couldn't leave. My camera is the only weapon I have against these attacks on the people of Gaza. The war on Gaza lasted 3 weeks and 2 days and caused 1,417 Palestinian and 13 Israeli deaths. A woman told me that I should meet a 10-year-old girl named Mona. 2 weeks earlier, she had lost 21 members of her extended family. Although she spoke without emotion, she was incredibly articulate. I went back to see her several times. With every visit, Mona repeated to me without any emotion details about the terrible day in January 2009. I think that Mona, like all of us in Gaza, is numbed by the destruction of our lives. So we keep repeating with more detail what has happened to us. The real question is the imprisonment of the people of Gaza. Why the continued occupation of Palestinian land and the massive collective punishment of its people? These are Palestinian stories. It is my story and the story of Mona Samouni.
Preview for Where Should the Birds Fly? Gaza film at deepdishtv.org, it says, in this closing credit of the trailer. I'm looking forward to it. I'll see you there, hopefully, 7 p.m. this Wednesday evening, October 2, 612 Ocean Street in Santa Cruz. Now for the two items that I mentioned just before I played that soundtrack for you. Israel prepares to drill for oil in occupied Golan. We're talking, of course, about the Golan or the Golan Heights, as I believe the locals refer to it, the local Syrian Arabs, the Golan Heights of southwestern Syria, bordering Israel. This comes to us, by the way, by Al Akhbar English. Israel prepares to drill for oil in occupied Golan. By Yahya Dabouk. Published Wednesday, September 25. Tel Aviv used to be called Jaffa in Arab Palestine and still recognized legally by the United States government and most countries around the world as the proper capital of the State of Israel. Tel Aviv is close to completing a geological survey of the occupied Golan Heights, where commercial deposits have been discovered. Up to 10 major drilling rigs could soon be pumping oil from the Syrian territory. Israeli media are reporting that the American oil company Genie Energy has completed a major geological survey in the southern part of the Golan and results are expected within a few weeks. Not surprisingly, the State of New Jersey-based Genie Energy, which was granted survey and drilling rights in the Golan last February from the Israeli government, is owned by rich Zionists like Howard Jones and media mogul Rupert Murdoch. The reports say drilling could start as soon as the survey is analyzed, pointing out that extracting oil in this area will be much easier and cheaper than it is in the Mediterranean, where oil and gas, natural gas, lie as deep as 5 kilometers, be roughly 3 miles, below the sea level. Some commentators did raise the issue of the Golan Heights being occupied land, making any such activity as extracting oil a violation of international law. However, Genie's Israeli manager, a foreign minister, is quoted as saying that he does not expect any international pressure on this matter, particularly from Syria, which is embroiled in an internal war. For its part, the Hebrew business daily Globes warned of a repeat of Israel's experience in the occupied Sinai Peninsula in the 1970s, when, as an occupying power, Tel Aviv extracted large amounts of petroleum, compensation for which the Egyptian government is still pursuing to this day, despite the Camp David Accords. I did not know that, my friends. The newspaper added that Cairo is in the process of drawing up a lawsuit against Israel around this very issue, asking for billions of dollars in compensation. And this article is an edited translation from the Arabic edition. As of last night, when I copied this, the text down, there were two comments from internet readers at that point in time. One anonymous, actually came from dating back to last Thursday. The solution is simple when dealing with these human parasites / land thieves. Make stealing the Syrian oil as hard as possible for them. Use your minds and come up with ways to make stealing the oil very, very hard and costly for Israel. Again, that is a comment on the article. It is not from the text of the article, per se. Second internet reader comment, who uses the handle Activist for Justice, also last Thursday. I am puzzled by the fact that oil was discovered in the Israeli-occupied portion of the Golan. Israel was pumping oil out of Egypt when they occupied the Sinai, but returned the land after a peace agreement was signed between the two countries. I suppose that if Syria and Israel sign a similar peace treaty, the Golan may well be returned to Syria. From what I've read in the past, Israel is 100% ready to return a good part of the Golan, which is better than not returning anything. I would like to get a hold of the material that this writer, that this internet commenter is referring to. She goes on, I have equally read that every year Syria, and this after the latest battle between them and Israel in reference to the October War of 1973, that Syria celebrates that war as a victory against Israel when, in fact, they, along with Egypt, lost the October War some 22 days after it started. By the 22nd day, the Israelis were some 40-odd kilometers from Syria, from Syria's capital, Damascus. As a Lebanese living in London, says this commenter, I have become more astute to Middle East history. Israel is a tiny country by comparison to its neighbors, and we Arabs whether we are Christians or Muslims, must stop lying to our people. I am far from pleased in having to say this, but if we concentrated more on technology and other forms of educational concepts, we would not be so handicapped against Israel when confronting our enemy. Look how Dubai has transformed their desert city into a cosmopolitan wonder. We need to follow Dubai's example by modernizing our culture and not remain the joke of those who see us solely as camel riders. Fairly well put. And regarding what this activist for justice says here about how this writer puts it, we Arabs, whether we are Christians or Muslims, must stop lying to our people. I've said since I started doing this show, some 16 months ago or so, that I had decided the only way for me to responsibly carry out the Mideast Madness show on free radio, underground radio here, pirate radio, is not to let Mideast Madness, the radio program, slip into just another venue for totally one-sided tirades against the bad guys, against the opposition. I have said in the past on in front of this microphone, I have had to confront and deal with, always, sadly, the things about Arab culture and the activities of certain Arab governments and certain Arab leaders that I found to be embarrassing and dishonest. And I believe that one has to be totally willing to accept those truths and not put the entire onus on the bad guy, as it were, on the opposition. In this case, the opposition being played the part of by Israel. Certainly, the mainstream Western press is going to tell you that one way or another, that certain Arabs cannot be trusted, Arab governments cannot be trusted. Yasser Arafat was a quote-unquote bad guy. As a leader of his people, Egyptian's President Nasser was highly questionable in this area. Sadat may have been to a degree. You know, the stereotypical lying, inherently dishonest Arabs who are just saying what they want to say out of desire to keep their power. Well, yeah, I know, that's true. Not entirely heard of amongst Netanyahu and various other leaders of Israel. Corruption abounds in the highest levels of Israeli government. Some of those people have been charged with crimes and even, I believe, spent some time in jail. Or at least on probation or something. Ehud Olmert comes to mind. So, I cannot avert my eyes from this writer's perception that she's really talking about their leaders, Arab leaders, whether Christians or Muslims, must stop lying to our people. And directly, this commenter is talking about how the Arab, the leaders of Syria and Egypt and throughout the Arab world were touting the 73 war as a victory for Arabs. Although in the reality on the ground is that most or all, perhaps even a little more land, still ended up by force back in the hands of the Israeli army. And I don't mind pointing out that the October War, the Yom Kippur War, is Israel eagerly refers to the dastardliness of the Arabs, quote-unquote dastardliness of them attacking on the most sacred, most solemn holiday in the Jewish tradition. That kind of thing goes on in war all the time, does it not? But when the Arabs do it, it's particularly fair playing field for casting aspersions. At any rate, it was clearly important for the governments clinging to power of the of these Arab countries to convince their people that for once they won something back from the Israelis. The Arab armies did give Israel a run for its money early in that war. So they wanted to make it, the Arab leaders wanted to make it look like a victory for the Arabs. And again, as I see it, it was not about destroying Israel, it was about winning back the Sinai Peninsula that Israel stole from Egypt in a surprise attack. And Syria winning back the Golan Heights, that likewise was taken from them by the Israelis in a well-rehearsed, well-calculated, and highly strategized assault in 1967, taking advantage of some very interesting political things that were happening there. Okay. And as I've spoken about in earlier episodes of Mideast Madness, there is the very blatant example of Israel going full steam ahead, or as far, fast as they can go ahead, on stealing natural gas from the Palestinian people, which clearly and undeniably lies under the sea. Within the ground, under the sea, that lies in Palestinian Gaza Strip waters of the Mediterranean Sea. Israel is in the process of helping itself to that natural gas oil field, denying that natural resource from the Palestinian people, along with the other fields of natural gas that lies in Israeli waters and perhaps even in international waters going farther west, which is all fascinating, especially given that Israelis have eagerly criticized Gaza for not taking the money that the government is more or less spending, supposedly spending on missiles and mortars that they have fired in the past into Israel from Gaza, making in military terms, in fatal terms, a dent in the collateral damage of the Israeli people, and not taking the money that they spend on those armaments and putting it into their economy. Well, here Israel is denying a natural resource of the Gazan Palestinians and preventing them from doing just that. Same thing is what this article is getting at is essentially the same thing, only this involves occupied Syria, the southwestern corner of Syria, west of Damascus, west of the capital, not very far from the capital. And Israel had some time ago annexed the Golan Heights, which in their eyes, in the Israeli government's eyes, takes it out of any package of negotiation for returning to Syria, as far as the Likud government in Tel Aviv, or Jerusalem, as they will say. The Golan is theirs to stay. Syria will never get it back. And here you have the Israelis, to some degree, taking advantage of the Syrian civil war to undercover of all the media attention on that civil war and beginning to extract oil from stolen Syrian land. Okay, folks, it's 6 minutes after 4 p.m., 1,600 six hours, this Monday, September 30. time for a musical break. And for me to take a wee-wee. Back to this wonderful gem of a CD I was playing this weekend for you. The Music of Arab Americans, a retrospective collection. Here is Lama Ya'albi for 6 minutes and 13 seconds of your time.
اسطوانات عالم فون المطربة سناء
لما
تفرحني لما يا قلبي يا قلبي يا قلبي لما يا قلبي يا قلبي يا قلبي يا قلبي يا
see, yeah, the first item you heard was Lama Yalbi, or When, O Heart of Mine. As I mentioned before, this is music all recorded in the United States, or somewhere in North America anyway, in the course of the 20th century. And the second piece you heard was Raqs Arabi, or Arabic dance. Some of this stuff goes back to, like, recordings of 1915 or earlier. That's 1915. This is the Mideast Madness radio program being carried to you through live streaming at freakradio.org on Free Radio Santa Cruz. Free Radio Santa Cruz is still very much alive, and we have a schedule accounting for most of the waking hours anyway, but there's something going on 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. You might even say we're on the air 24/7, hey, including a lot of programs that are downloaded from other sources around the Bay Area, KPFA and KPFK in particular. For all I know, I'm not even supposed to say that on pirate radio, but we do repeat programs, commercial programs that have been made available to us through the internet. And we were, up until 3 months ago, broadcasting on the air at a low wattage of power for the city of Santa Cruz at 101.3 FM. We expect to be returning soon to 101.3 FM for traditional radio service. In the meantime, those who are listening, obviously on your respective computers, little PCs there, please remind your friends when they go to the freakradio.org website to click on the red oval if they want to hook up to the streaming radio service of pirate radio a la Santa Cruz. It's 20 minutes past 4 in the afternoon this Monday, September 30. I'm really upset right now. I'm having one of the usual headaches that I have to put up with in trying to archive my downloaded programs. I have the damn program from, like, for example, last Saturday. I have it in my folder. I just can't seem to download the goddamn thing. It's very upsetting. This one is being recorded as I speak. If I don't do something stupid and press the wrong button and delete that, then it will be available for another shoddy attempt at archiving it. Okay, nobody wants to hear me bitching. Back to the other grind. The conflict at hand between Israelis and Arabs, between Jews and Muslims, Christians, and none of the above. F-A-T-A-H, Fatah, or as some will pronounce it, Fatah, is one of many aging, perhaps, to put it accurately, combination political and military fronts that the Palestinians have long had, often considered, most or all of these viewed by the Palestinians as being each of them under the umbrella of the Palestine Liberation Organization. Fatah is the late Yasser Arafat's old group that he was, of course, he's the chairman of the PLO. And he sort of hails from Fatah, his earlier Liberation Front. From Al Monitor, the pulse of the Middle East, is Fatah's armed wing making a comeback? A very colorful picture here of Palestinian Fatah members carrying their weapons, typical AK-47s, I think, as they take part in a parade to mark the 65th anniversary of the Palestinian catastrophe, or the Nakba, in the Palestinian refugee camp Ain al-Hilwe, near the port city of Sidon, southern Lebanon, May 15th of this year. Photo by Reuters. And Ali Ashishu. They are, of course, wearing masks, black masks, with only their eyes and lips and the tips of their noses showing. The familiar Palestinian kafia or hedda or hatta headdress, covered with a black baseball cap and yellow warriors tied yellow banner around the cap. The kind of picture you'd see in, say, Life magazine back around 1970. Another stereotypical image of the big bad Arab terrorists. But these are, at least these are wielding guns, rifles, instead of merely cloaking themselves with an explosive-laden vest to blow themselves up with. These guys are ready to fight like soldiers, it looks like. Okay, is Fatah's armed wing making a comeback? Brought to you by Al Monitor. Written by Nila Khalil for Al Monitor Palestine Pulse. Translated by Kamal Fayad. Ramallah in the West Bank. Ramallah is the de facto capital of the state of Palestine for now. Anyway, Ramallah in the West Bank. The deaths of two Israeli soldiers last weekend in the West Bank towns of Qalqilah on September 21 and Hebron on September 22 significantly added to the insecurity that has prevailed in the West Bank since the resumption of negotiations on July 30th, some 2 months ago. The West Bank witnessed a number of incursions in August by Israeli occupation forces that left 6 martyrs. What does that mean? It means the Israeli defense forces, as the Israelis refer to them, defense forces, killed 6 Palestinians. And pretty much anyone who meets their demise at the hands of an Israeli, whether it's a soldier, a settler, or anyone else who is Israeli, is automatically viewed as a martyr to the cause. That's my clarification there. Back to the article. Omar Abu Arkub, a journalist specializing in the Hebrew press, told Al Monitor that the Israeli media, quote, had hastened to hold the Fatah-affiliated Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigades responsible for the Hebron operation and began inciting against Fatah and the Palestinian Authority, or the PA. Israeli media outlets accused the PA of not condemning the killings of Israelis, and even claiming that some of the PA's leaders were also guilty of incitement, as they put it. Fueling this Israeli incitement campaign were fiery statements that spread among the Palestinian populace by Hebron native and member of Fatah's Central Committee, Abbas Zaki, who affirmed in press statements that the Israeli soldier killed in Hebron was not there on a picnic. Israeli accusations aimed at Fatah, fiery statements by some Fatah leaders, the scrutinization of the political identities of martyrs who fell in Qalandia's 2 refugee camps near Ramallah and in the Jenin refugee camp, as well as the armed skirmishes between security forces and some Fatah members in the Nablus camp, all lead to the belief that Fatah's military wing had returned to the forefront of Palestinian armed resistance in the West Bank. This is alongside a small presence by the Islamic Jihad's Al-Quds Brigades, a member of which was assassinated by occupation forces in the Jenin camp, the Jenin refugee camp, on September 17. I have a quotation here. The Israelis have in the past accused the Al-Aqsa Martyrs and Al-Quds Brigades of controlling Palestinian refugee camps, particularly in the northern areas of the West Bank, which constitutes a threat to Israel and the PA alike. Khalil Shaheen, a writer and political analyst at the Palestinian Center for Research for Policy Research and Strategic Studies, stated to Al-Monitor. Despite his assertion about the existence of, quote, difficulties in casting blame for the Qalqilia and Hebron operations as a result of increasing Israeli violations that provide fertile ground for the development of organized or individual Palestinian resistance efforts, Shaheen added, proving that the Al-Aqsa Brigades were responsible for the death of the two soldiers would result in great problems for Fatah, the leaders of which are conducting negotiations with Israel. A statement by Fatah Al-Intifada was circulated in the media claiming responsibility for the death of the Israeli soldier in Hebron. Here we must differentiate between Fatah and Fatah Al-Intifada, which broke away from Fatah, that is now leading the peace process, and emphasize the hostile nature of the relationship between the two, prominent Fatah leader Nabil Amro affirmed to Al-Monitor. Fatah Al-Intifada is a Palestinian faction that split from Fatah in 1983 to oppose Yasser Arafat with Syrian support. It is still active in Syria, Jordan, and Lebanon, and had not previously played a role in the Palestinian-occupied territories prior to the Hebron operation, which it quickly claimed responsibility for in a statement that was published in the media. But, according to Shaheen, what increases the likelihood that the Al-Aqsa Brigades are responsible for the two operations is, and I quote, the public appearance of armed Al-Aqsa Brigade's elements in the Nablus and Jenin camps in the north of the West Bank. This probably means that internal disputes are raging inside Fatah on the one hand, and between the security agencies, that would be Palestinian security agencies under the PA, and armed Fatah members on the other. Shaheen continues. That's the quote from Shaheen. Here's another quotation. All the names, a downright paragraph, in fact, all the names being circulated, such as the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigades, Hebron Knights, the Yasser Arafat Brigades, and others, are all pseudonyms for the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigades, the military arm of Fatah. The different nomenclatures came probably as a result of the fact that most Al-Aqsa Brigade's members signed pledges with Israel and the PA not to engage in any armed actions in return for pardons and promises not to be targeted for assassination or arrest, as stipulated by the United States Dayton Plan, Dayton, Ohio Plan of 2006. Which aimed to dismantle the Al-Aqsa Brigade's military wing and replace its military leaders with political leaders. End quote. This according to a young Fatah leader who spoke to Al-Monitor on condition of anonymity. Shit. Ahmed Abu Al-Azim, an academic and political analyst at Birzeit University in the West Bank, believes that there are still Palestinians who welcome military operations and endorse armed resistance without conditions or strategies. Those who support military operations against Israeli occupation may not belong to any specific political faction or maybe members of Fatah who still proclaim belonging to Fatah's military wing, the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigades, and who spearheaded military operations during the Qalandia refugee camp invasion of August 2013 and the Qalqilya operation. It is certain that these operations greatly upset President Mahmoud Abbas, who does not endorse armed resistance. His anger further exasperated by the fact that some members of Fatah, which he heads, sanction and insist on this type of resistance effort, Abu al-Azm said. In light of this, no one was surprised by the media squabbling that took place between Palestinian and Israeli outlets concerning Abbas' position about the killing of the two soldiers. For a while, the Palestinian media outlets relayed his statement word for word. "We condemn and denounce the killings and ask that Israelis also condemn the killings," end quote. Their Israeli counterparts merely said that Abbas condemned the killings and offered his condolences to the families of the soldiers. In other words, the Israeli counterparts allegedly did not relay Abbas's request that the Israelis also condemn the killings, taking the onus off of the Israeli soldiers, occupiers. Continuing, "The facts on the ground thus reflect the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade's return to the resistance scene on the West Bank in a manner that goes beyond mere accusations made against them by occupation forces. To actually engage those same forces in battle when they conduct night raids in refugee camps." Talking about Israeli occupation forces conducting night raids in refugee camps. "These brigades are also silently clashing with factions inside Fatah itself, whose official stance insists on negotiations, while some of its members still insist on carrying arms and resisting." Biographical note, author Naila Khalil is a reporter for the Palestinian daily newspaper Al-Ayam. She has reported for the United Nations Humanitarian News and Analysis Agency IRIN, the UAE magazine of the United Arab Emirates, a nation on the Gulf, the Arabian Gulf magazine Al-Mara al-Muslima, the Jordanian daily Al-Dustur, and the An-Najah Office for Media and Journalism. I hope you're all taking notes. Lots of ins and outs, aren't there, folks? You know, when I read these pieces to you that contain a lot of details about who is who and the many, many foreign-sounding names of this faction or that political wing or this breakaway group, it's not like you're going to be taking. It's not like I'm going to give you a pop quiz later on. I report the news as I receive it, and far from being much better or any better than my listeners at retaining any of this stuff, I can glean this from it. There are, as there have been during my lifetime, pretty much all of my lifetime, and I was born in 53, faction upon faction upon splintered breakaway faction, whether it be they the military wing of that group or the political directors of that wing, or those who were supposed to be responsible. Yes, it never seems to stop. And it doesn't take a lot of imagination for someone to understand that there's a lot of frustration involved, a lot of stirrings amongst the people who were under the occupation of another nation that was stolen from them to begin with. And I mean stolen. Stolen. I make no qualms or apologies for saying that. Yes, it's easy to dismiss those who are under occupation, many of whom are armed, as people who are good at little more than a lot of infighting and sabotage of their own efforts. Then again, you have to look at a number of realities. How long has this occupation been going on? Well, if you're talking about the West Bank, the famous West Bank or the Gaza Strip, some 46 years. If you're talking about the foundation of the Jewish State of Israel, as the Israelis prefer it to be, have dreamt of it since the 1890s or even before that to be, we're talking some 68 years. 65 years, I guess. I mean, in the course of 6.5 decades, with no end in sight to the divisions and the refusal of one side or the other to accept certain realities, or the other guy's rendition of it, the very word of international law, there's going to be squabbling. There are going to be internal confrontations. And while some people may dismiss this as all too typical, stereotypical, unsophisticated Arab internal strife, there's another way, and I've used this expression before, which really is very revealing. In a single expression, divide and conquer. The Israelis know all too well the value of maintaining the status quo, of holding on to their Jewish state, expanding, founding and expanding with no end in sight Jewish settlements in occupied territories, which, by the way, is against international law. You're not supposed to do that. The very military occupation of those lands has long been itself is a violation of international agreement. So the Israelis are continuing to take advantage of this pathetic situation where, with Palestinians having little or no real control over their lives in terms of government, economy, policy, and in other ways, they're going to squabble. The Israelis know that the Palestinians will implode upon themselves. That's what I mean by divide and conquer. Let them, the Palestinians, make asses out of themselves, the Israelis will tell you, or at least speak of it amongst themselves, and that way they can flaunt themselves as the civilizing force in that part of the Middle East, in that part of the world, and raise the mantle of their glorious Israeli democracy and claim to be the only one in the Middle East, when they will not even allow a truly democratic Palestine to emerge. The Israelis, Benjamin Netanyahu, his Likud government, the ultra-rightists, are perfectly content to let the Palestinians implode upon themselves out of their own frustration for their inability to make any headway in creating a state, in creating and maintaining a Palestinian culture, which is really caused by restraints perpetrated on them, upon them by the Israelis. That's how I see that. It is 4:42 this Monday, September 30th. by Allison Phillips from her column. Her column, I guess, in the Mirror, the UK Mirror. UK is in United Kingdom. Headlines this article, "Why Are We So Afraid of a Woman in a Veil?" 18 September. Allison Phillips writes, "I'd rather wear a veil than a thong or suspenders or those strange nipple tassel things. Or in fact, most of those other uncomfy creations devised to satisfy men. One of the major arguments being lobbed around this week as to why Muslim women shouldn't be wearing veils in public is because they are a symbol of male dominance in society. As if knicker skimming dresses aren't," she writes. "Women in Britain today really aren't in a position to be lecturing Muslim women. Women in Britain today really aren't in a position to be lecturing Muslim women on what they should and shouldn't wear to assert their identity. On the streets of our cities every night of the year, there are girls in outfits created purely for the pleasure of men. Never in history have women been more sexualized in our society. Never has their physical form been more analyzed and criticized, both by men and women. We, Great Britain, have become a nation obsessed by the way we look, as the selfies generation is testament. Any physical imperfection must be immediately addressed at any cost or risk. Meanwhile, the emotional and intellectual imperfections go unchallenged. In terms of women being able to express themselves more freely, there might be a lot to be said for the veil. Yet Judge Peter Murphy was absolutely right to demand that a Muslim woman remove her full-face veil when giving evidence in the case against her for intimidating a witness. Because a jury being able to see the woman's face in this case is vital to ensuring that justice is being done. And crucially, that it is being seen to be done. But beyond that, on the streets and in the schools, hospitals, workplaces, and hotels, why should a woman be compelled to reveal her face if she doesn't wish to? What business is it of anyone else how she dresses? And what reason can there be to demand that a woman shows her face everywhere she goes other than fear? Fear of people who look a bit different. Fear of people with religious faith. Fear that because she is a Muslim, she might have extremist, perhaps murderous tendencies. If we are angry at the way immigration has been handled in this country, again, Ms. Phillips speaking of her native Great Britain, let's get angry and demand answers from the authorities. But let's not be fearful. Fear says far more about our own mindsets than it does about the realities of the situation. When did we as a nation become so scared? Not so long ago, if a woman went down the street wearing a spacesuit, so long as she was polite to the people she passed, abided by the law, and didn't push in at the bus queue, there would be no problem. Our history has been one of self-confidence, where we were big enough to accept people who were different, looked different, and wore different clothes. We are, after all, a nation of immigrants, from the Angles and Saxons to Romans and Vikings and on and on. There is just a tiny number of women in Britain wearing the full burqa or niqab, which covers the face but leaves an area around the eyes exposed. Full burqa or niqab. Yet, despite the small number of women involved, it has become a massive issue. Why? Because it suits the scaremongers and haters to shine attention onto those who are different. Those who they can paint as somehow sinister. And by doing so, they deflect us from the real inequalities in our society and the real sinister things that go on. Don't be fooled by the debate. In this issue, we need to look behind the veil. Again, a piece by Alison Phillips of the UK Mirror. I'm checking out her bio right now. Or what I assumed would be her bio. A British writer here. It just has more stuff by her. But she clearly is a writer for, perhaps a reporter with, the UK Mirror. Okay. Get rid of that one there. Well, a very short article, really. It kind of drives me nuts how she seems to hate long paragraphs. Almost every sentence is a mini paragraph within itself, but that's just a matter of my personal preference here. I think there is, obviously she's trying to be enlightening, if a tad naive. Indeed, here are the internet comments about this article. Ian Higgins, or someone with the handle Ian Higgins, writes, I wonder how much of this is driven by a desire to stand out from the rest of society, to be obviously different, special in some way. Making a statement that you don't want to interact with anyone who doesn't share your own particular view of the world. In that respect, surely it can only be divisive and have a negative effect on the cohesion of our society. Or is that the point? Yeah. Well, at least I read that to you, following the article. Helen Slape, internet commenter, writes, does the writer realize that the veil was designed to satisfy men? Judging from its appearance and what I have read about women who wear the veil, it is not a comfortable piece of clothing to wear. Good point. Here's a real long one. Fasten your seatbelts. Pam Kearney, apparently a female, writes, in response to this article, to act obtuse is to act with ill-feigned deliberation when discussing Britain's objection to the streets being filled with burqas going about their daily chores. As you know, although you dumb it down well, it's not just about the burqa, but the Muslims shove to push Britain to concede to their demands for a multitude of changes to Britain's religious beliefs, laws. Is it just about the burqa? No, it's not. Is it about the Islamification of Britain? Yes. According to this commenter, is it about non-Muslims not allowed areas? Yes. Is it about Sharia law in Britain? Yes. Is it about being force-fed halal food? Yes. Is it about the government's fear of upsetting the Muslims and being branded racist bigots? Yes. Is it about denying the Britain's basic rights in the country Britons fought and died to protect? Yes. Is it about Sharia emirates in Britain, where the Briton cannot smoke, listen to music, drink alcohol, hold hands with their partner, or steal a kiss in public? Yes. Is conceding defeat and allowing the Muslims to refuse to integrate into British society by allowing them to walk around hidden from view from infidels in their burqas a powerful shove by the Muslims to force Britain to allow them to do so a mistake? Yes. If a British man walks into a bank wearing a motorbike helmet or balaclava, is he told, remove or leave the bank? Yes. If a Muslim woman walks into a bank wearing a burqa niqab, is she ordered to unveil her face? No. Is it a man or a woman beneath that burqa clutching a weapon to rob that bank? You tell me. Am I racist? No. Am I patriotic? Yes. Am I a bigot? No. Could all this make me a racist bigot? God, yes. Will I play Christmas hymns at Christmas even if it really upsets my Muslim neighbor? Yes, in all capital Y-E-S's letters. Will I decorate my house or garden at Christmas? Yep. Will they stop me doing so? No. As for the author of this article, 10 or 20 years' time, if it takes that long, you, with your makeup, blonde hair, skirts, stockings, and high-heeled shoes, will be chased off the streets of wherever you live because you are not wearing a hijab. I hope I'm alive to read your articles then, except you'll probably be out of England and living in France, where they have banned the burqa. No, I'm not going to take on that Pam Kearney character. She, or is it a he, describing himself with a woman's name, knows how they feel and makes some very excellent points. And just in case you're wondering, I, as a Palestinian American, am not Muslim, nor was my family Muslim, nor was I or my three sisters raised as Muslims. We grew up in the Lutheran Church. My father was a Christian Palestinian from Jerusalem, just in case you were wondering. Julie Brownlee says, you can't tell if it's a woman or a geezer under the veil. Ban them everywhere, I say. That is Julie Brownlee's entire statement, stated with just as much fervor and resolve as that huge piece I read from Kearney. Kath Sean Morris O'Donoghue. Well, folks, it's 4:55. I'm sorry I cannot finish the internet comments that I retain for that piece. Don't forget, I'm here doing the Mideast Madness show every Monday at 3 p.m. for a couple of hours. Also, Mideast Madness, the weekend edition, every Saturday from 11 a.m. to 1 in the afternoon. Thank you for joining me. Mideast Madness at gmx.com. Tell your friends to click on the red oval. Power to the pooples and the sheeples and all the rest of us. Ta-ta.